Good evening. Welcome to the seventh call for our winter series. This is Perry Hoffman again, and we're so happy to have Dr. Charlie Swenson back with us, who's going to be talking more about DBT and some other things that Charlie has in mind. So we're very excited to start this call tonight with Charlie. I'm going to also ask people who have so generously sent in a donation. One person did already for this call, so I thank you. You know who you are. And those of you who still are thinking to do it, please do it so we can continue to provide this service to people at no charge. It's now my pleasure to turn over the evening to Dr. Charlie Swenson, a dear friend and colleague.
All right. Charlie? Thank you, Perry. I did this once already. Some of you may have been on that call, and it's still a weird thing to just be on your telephone, you know. And my kids actually said tonight, you mean people are going to listen to you for an hour, Dad? And it was like, I said, yes. And they said, oh, my God, do they have to pay for that? So, you know, you're all on mute, so I have no idea what anybody's thinking any of the time, so I'll just go along. Anyway, I want to thank Perry and NEA BPD. I continue to think it's a growingly amazing organization in an area where there was nothing. There are now two or three advocacy organizations, and I think NEA BPD plays an unbelievable role and keeps getting better. So I appreciate being able to be part of it and to contribute. I spoke, we deferred this call. We were going to do it a few weeks ago, but then it came up at the same time as the Super Bowl. So we decided to defer it. I, in particular, was going to be watching that with my boys. And so now tonight I realize we're up against the Academy Awards. And I just thought, you know, we're not going to defer it again. We'll just go head-to-head against the Academy Awards and see how it comes out. But I hope it's not a loss for too many of you. Next, what do I want to say? For those of you who were not on the first call, just to know, I mean, Perry and I go way back, be our DBT beginnings, basically, in the early 1990s, so it is fun to reconnect. And I'm going to make the topic is, as it was last time, I'm calling it Getting DBT and Getting DBT into the Real World. And what I said last time is that these are inextricable from each other. Getting DBT into the real world, as many of you know, from different, I'm assuming that there might be people who are, you know, who've been clients who are on the phone, people who have been family members, people who are advocates, people who run programs, people who are therapists. No matter what angle it comes from, I think if you've been in a situation where there's been an effort to put DBT into the real world, you realize that every day something new comes up, some question that requires you to ask, you know, if we're trying to do DBT in fidelity to the model, what do we do about this situation? I mean, I was consulting to an organization this week with a residential DBT program. Actually, it's a complex program, a complex organization. And they have an outpatient department. And in their outpatient department, they have a DBT adherent program they're trying to develop and strengthen. And in the same outpatient department, they have a lot of non-DBT programs and groups. And so the clients in the DBT adherent program go also to other kinds of groups, anger management groups, substance abuse group, maybe a family interaction group. There's many, many groups. And they share the group with people who don't have DBT, and it raises questions every day about how the consequences of certain behaviors might be handled differently with DBT people than non-DBT people. And what you run into every day is one or another dialectic, and the dialectic in that kind of situation might be stated as something like this. On the one hand, we want to do DBT with the DBT adherent people as close to the standard model, the evidence-based model, as is humanly possible, really be adherent to that. And at the same time, the people running the program have to have the other, another part of the dialectic is, on the other hand, we have to have a program that works for everybody and that makes sense to everybody. And so to what degree do you do things differently for the people doing DBT and the people not doing DBT? That's just an example because it comes to mind because it happened to be a couple days ago, but it happens all the time. I'm going to make some assumptions in talking here. One is that you have access or you can easily get access to the PowerPoint presentation that I asked Perry to post on the website, and it's called Getting DBT and Getting DBT into the Real World, because I'm going to sort of walk through some of the things in that PowerPoint, probably not cover every bit of it. And there's also was a diagram from the last talk that didn't get reproduced for this one, but it's available to you on the website if you go back to the last one I did a couple months ago. If you can go to the that you can easily find that. And there, because there's a picture basically of a tree that I call the DBT tree. And I'll get back to that because I won't be on that right away, but that could be just a useful metaphor for what I'm going to talk about. So I'm making those assumptions that you might have access to those, and I hope you do. So I'm going to talk some. If we get time, I'm going to ask for questions, which then can be, I think, emailed in to Perry, and then Perry can bring them up to me, or she could ask you to elaborate on them. And finally, the last few minutes, I want to talk a little about a series, a monthly series that I'm proposing and that Perry is going to support having us do with NEABPD on the telephone. I'll talk to you about it later. All right. One of the interesting things about doing so many DBT implementations and so much DBT over the many years that I've done it is that you increasingly and continually refine an understanding of what is the essence of the treatment as opposed to what are some of the trappings. And the essence of the treatment, meaning the basic ideas, the basic principles, the foundations of it, and some of the some of the guidelines. The reason you learn those is that every time you do a different treatment with DBT, another client, another program or something, you really have to sort it out. And so after quite a while, you start to say, oh, okay, I get the basic idea. Then it's helpful to you from then on. So what I want to share with you is some of the basic ideas and how they differ from the trappings or some of the things that change from one situation to another. I'm going to go into this starting out with a story from my personal life because it was through this story that I think it helped me even way before I even heard of DBT or way before it was developed. It sort of had within it, what are the a couple of the basic ingredients. And it's been very helpful to me, so I'm going to just take a chance that it might be helpful to some of you. It goes way back. When I was a kid, probably 8 or 9 years old, I'd say by 9 or 10, let's say by fourth grade, I had developed my idea of my future. I wanted to be an NBA basketball player. I was in a town where we played all the time. I had brothers. We played basketball all the time. And I had an image of myself as I grew up that that's what I would do. I played. I was one of the kids that played on my driveway and just constantly went to any gym that was open in our little town in Oregon where I grew up. Joined everything I could, and I was a pretty good player. I was especially a good shooter. I was a pretty smart player. But there was a really big problem, which is that I was a really slow runner. And as a slow runner, it was really hard to get to keep up with other players, and this became more important as time went by. And I was as a slow runner, it would come out in the gym, in gym class at school, when we had to stand at one end of the gym and then run to the other end, and I'd be the last. And so I got it was very disappointing, and I by the time I was 15, I was starting to give up on my dream. By the time I was 16, it was pretty much over. And it was really crushing. Quite a few years later, probably 30, I was in psychoanalytic training. And I was, as part of that training and as a personal experience, I was in a psychoanalysis. And in that psychoanalysis, I was talking about the collapse of my dream. And as I talked about it, I could tell that my therapist, my analyst, I thought, really didn't get it. Because he started saying things like, but what makes you think you're so slow? I said, well, I am so slow. But what makes you think you are? Well, I just know I am. I know how fast I run. I time myself. But what makes you think you're so slow? And as he continued to repeat this, I got increasingly annoyed. Until I just asked him, I just told him to stop saying it. And there was a long pause, and he would say, man, what makes you think you're so slow? With an emphasis on the word think. And I didn't talk about it any. I just got sick of it. He had really been good at understanding me in many ways and really had been helpful. And I just felt like he didn't get it. He didn't understand it. So I stopped talking about it. And meanwhile, I went out. And I started running on a track, and I found a guy, hooked up with a guy who knew how to run. And I had him watch me, and I had him coach me. And to make a longer story short, he gave me all kinds of pointers, took me under his wing, kept track of how I was doing, would check in with me, and meanwhile, I got faster and faster over the next 3 months. And I was running these races where I had ridiculously slow times, and then they got faster, these 5-mile races and 10-mile races, until I was actually running pretty fast, and really regretting that I hadn't learned this when I was younger. I just never thought this was something you could do anything about. And I'll stop about it right there and just say, it was a profound experience. I mean, you'd have to know how slow I was and then that I actually came up to being a reasonable speed, not fast, but, you know, the times would sound pretty decent. And I learned, and it stayed with me ever since, that in order to really tackle incredibly difficult, stubborn behavioral patterns, like slow running, where you're pretty hopeless about it, you need two approaches at once. You need someone who is addressing your motivation. And I would say the analyst was doing that. At that moment, he was doing it in an interesting, challenging, provocative way, and it got me thinking about it and got me thinking, I wonder what the limit really is. And it just sort of got under my skin. But he did motivate me to go out and give it a try. But I don't think it would have worked if I didn't find the other guy. So the other thing that I needed was a coach. And so I came to believe, and even when I was in psychoanalytic training, compared to some of my colleagues, I was more of the persuasion that you really need help changing your behavior. You can't just assume that if you understand things, your behavior is going to change. I mean, understanding things in his own right is really interesting and great and satisfying, and I still find that satisfying. But if you're really going to change stubborn behavioral patterns, you really need somebody who's really attending to your motivation and someone who's really attending to the mechanics of what you do. And obviously, DBT, when I encountered it, without thinking at the time that that made it so appealing to me, over the years I realized that really made it appealing to me, because the same program attends to motivation. The individual therapist attends to motivation through developing a powerful relationship, through looking at your chain of behaviors with behavioral chain analyses, looking at the consequences of your behaviors and how they might need to change in order to generate new behaviors and reinforce them, and all kinds of things like that. Just really detailed look at what's motivating you. Why are you hopeless? What can you do about it? And then somebody is attending to that you need to know how to regulate your emotions, and you need to know how to say no to people if they're running over you, and you need to know how to get yourself back in balance if you're just constantly feeling confused or, in DBT terms, dysregulated in one way or another. So, you know, the idea that there is a motivator and a coach in the same model, and it's actually a team that works close together, and even the therapist, him or herself, serves both those functions, but has always been appealing to me. And so whatever else you might say about a DBT model and how different one might look from the other one down the road, how different the DBT program for the teenagers and families might look from the adult residential program down the road, what they both have is absolutely, if they're well done, they attend to motivation and they attend to capabilities. If you have somebody who wants to die by suicide, you have to assume in DBT, if it's been a regular pattern, that they're going to need real focus on motivation, that their hopelessness is probably warranted, it's probably understandable, and you're really going to have to work on motivation. But if you only do that, as Marsha Linehan would say, you might be really good at getting into hell with the patient and seeing what hell is like, but it might not help you get them out of hell. The coach gets them out of hell, the coach part of the treatment. So any DBT program, no matter what else it's made up of, at its core is going to be attending to capabilities and generating skills and so on, and attending to motivation. So that is just one place to start about this. I want to introduce the DBT tree again. Some of you were on the line last time and would have seen it. But, you know, now I have a PowerPoint. As I promised last time, I said I would send along a PowerPoint that sort of goes through the tree, and I did that, and so you've got that. They kind of go together. Also, by the way, those of you who managed to stay all the way to the end of the last call would have heard me sing a song, which is, I don't think, going to be standard fare. I don't do that in every talk I give, and it won't be one today, but I sang a song, and some people liked it and asked if they could get it, so I sent it to Perry, and she put it on the website. I don't know, Perry, did you send it to people also?
No, I didn't. It's posted. I thought we'd have a sing-along at the end of this.
You did? You'll have to unmute people, because a sing-along is not much fun if all you hear is yourself.
I'll unmute people. That'll be fine.
We'll see if we get time for that. Okay, so I'm going to look at the tree and the PowerPoint. Let me say what the point of the tree is that for those of you who've been to DBT workshops, and my guess is a lot of you have, whether you've been to an intensive workshop that lasts 10 days, a foundational workshop that lasts 5 days, a two-day workshop that introduces DBT, in a way, the agenda is all on this tree. I mean, this tree sort of is something over many years of teaching DBT I came to put together as a way of saying, here's the whole thing, here's the table of contents of the whole treatment. If you know everything in this tree in detail, you know DBT. And there's some things about this tree that, as I point them out to you, I think may be helpful in sort of separating out the parts of DBT that are common to every program and every individual treatment, and then the ones that sort of vary from case to case or program to program. So I've found it useful not only in terms of just organizing the treatment in my head, but in organizing it when I do a consultation of a program. I look at the tree and I look at the program and I sort of match up and I say, wait a minute, this program, are they strong in this area? Do they have enough of this? Do they have enough of that? And so it's a helpful exercise. All right, so I wanted to just introduce the tree, and then there's slides that kind of walk us through some things about it. And as we go, I'm hoping to just make a few teaching points. So we're going to really start right at the beginning, even though some of you went through some of this before, but this might add a little to it. The first slide says DBT program implementation, meaning developing of a new DBT program or altering one is a process. It's not an event. It just is every day. It is just constantly. It's part of what dialectics is. Dialectics is a philosophy in the world that even though there's a whole history to that concept and there are different people who have developed the philosophy of dialectics and they've written about it, tons written about it, it's all about movement and change. It's all about movement and change. Dialectics is all about improvisation, flexibility, complexity, movement, and change. And so when you develop a program, it's, if you don't just keep moving and keep going over things that come up and just welcome them every day because it's never going to be done. So that's one. And then second, it says it's the step between adopting a DBT plan. It'd be like creating a design. I've worked recently with a psychoanalytic institution that is considering developing a DBT skills training program within it. And in looking at that, we developed a plan, a design. That's before they've even tried to do it. So implementation is once you've developed a plan which is true to DBT, and this plan is, in a more selective way, true to DBT principles and strategies, it's then practicing and improving it. It's putting it in place. And it, as it says here, it is a saga and it's a war. Those are my experiences, is that it's interesting. If you don't like that kind of thing, if you don't like sort of a saga and a war, then it's really not the thing. It's not for perfectionists that are just going to die every time something's done that's not right. You just keep moving in that right direction. It requires all these things, it says vision, passion, strategy, creativity. And the fact that it's an evidence-based practice, DBT, with well over 10 randomized controlled trials in different kinds of settings and with different kinds of disorders, really burdens you because you really want to get it in place in an evidence-based way. So you have to approximate the standard research-based model of DBT as much as you can without knowing for sure which part of the model is the critical part, which part is the necessary prerequisite to your program to get outcomes. So you really have to just put it in place as close to the evidence-based practice as you can. That's what I mean. It's a burden in that way compared to putting in place a model that has no research on it, where you can just vary it all kinds of ways. In DBT, you want to get it right. And then also, you need to adapt it. You need to vary it based on the setting. Successful implementation requires getting DBT. You really have to try to preserve it. It's just what I was saying, as it is, and then make modifications. And there's always modifications. There's the modification for DBT with developmental disabilities and cognitive deficits. I mean, as soon as you start trying to teach the standard skill set to people with IQs between 50 and 70, you start to find, wow, there's way too many words on the page, and the words are way too complex. And the fact that they have trouble digesting that, there's too heavy, as they would say, of a cognitive load, just means you then have to make adaptations to it and really make it work for that population. So you really have to, it challenges you to know what's crucial about the skills and to kind of repackage them, as Julie Brown has done in her treatment of DBT for developmental disabilities and cognitive deficits in Eastern Massachusetts, and has put out a book called The Skills System, where she's repackaged a lot of the skills into 10 skills. But on the other hand, she teaches all the skills in addition to that, but with a change in what types of language you use, what kind of pictures are used, and so on. So, you adapt, but you try to stay true to it as you go. Let's look at the next slide. The primary dialectic in DBT is, as I've been saying, is to try to adopt it with high fidelity to the model and adapt it as absolutely needed, making modifications. Early in my DBT aspect of my career, during the 90s, having gone a couple of times to the forensic program that Robin McCann and her colleague Alyssa Ball were developing in the forensic program, forensic hospital in Colorado, I came in at the early stage and then sort of later in the early stage of that implementation, and it was a saga, and it was a war. I mean, Robin, some of you may have been to trainings with Robin, fantastic, really smart person teaching forensics as well as just standard DBT. But boy, you would see she and her colleague coming out of meetings crying. The staff just humbled them. I mean, it was just like trying to get that model that had compassion in it and validation of the clients in a forensic setting with most people there for not guilty by reason of insanity sentences, sometimes well over a decade, was really challenging. And they just kept doing it. They did a little bit at a time, they did a little bit at a time. And when I was there, they were doing this really interesting thing where they had a committee with patients, their forensic patients, all men, sitting around going through every skill in the skills book, talking about how to modify it for that population and that setting, and having really interesting dialogues. They really just took a dialectical approach. They assumed that there was wisdom to Marsha Linehan's skills, and there was wisdom to the inmates there about what would work. And they just gradually modified the skills package until they had a different skills package that was still based on all of the same things. And it made it interesting not only because it was different in some ways, but the level of buy-in in the program, it was just a brilliant thing to do. They had this very high buy-in by people who didn't have much buy-in before that to any treatment model. Next slide says the big picture. So this is the big picture of the tree. So we're going to look at the tree now. The elements and steps of implementation can be seen as a tree. The climate around the tree, the surrounding vegetation, and the soil represent the pre-DBT context of the program. I would say the place where Perry and I started doing DBT, New York Hospital in White Plains, New York. If you looked at the soil, the pre-DBT soil, it was very hierarchical, hospital with 13 units, very medically oriented, very psychoanalytically oriented, no knowledge, essentially, that was put into place. Well, not no. There was knowledge of behaviorism, but I would say the leading knowledge of behaviorism was probably on Kathy Halmy's eating disorder program. But mostly it was psychoanalytic, and so you'd have to say that the soil there didn't include much behaviorism. So if one of the roots of DBT is behaviorism or CBT, you'd have to reckon with that one way or another, either ahead of time or during the implementation. You'd have to realize, oh my God, we don't have much CBT in the soil here. And that doesn't just mean expertise, it also means support. So there wasn't much support for doing a CBT model of treatment, and especially with patients that had the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, because there was a model there that was more psychoanalytic and was really a big part of the hospital. So you'd have to say, we're going to have to do something about the soil, and if you had a garden and you discovered what ingredients weren't there, you'd look for some kind of fertilizer. So metaphorically, I think that DBT programs are wise to assess the nature of the soil and then use fertilizer. So we had to get a bunch of behavioral training. We had to really convert some of our time to taking ourselves to behaviorists. And other places, I would say, for instance, I've done a lot of work with programs in Vermont across the border from Western Massachusetts, where I am. And Vermont programs, somehow all of them are just unbelievably dialectical. They are creative. They are just smart. They're good at movement. They're just good at coming up with just new ideas about how to make things happen. So they kind of have tons of dialectical whatever that is in the soil. But they also actually don't have much straight CBT. And the problem with that for Vermont and for our hospital, where I was in New York, is that CBT is just, you can't. There's no way you can do without it. We'll get to that, but it's so dependent on and driven by getting people into problem solving of a CBT nature. So you'd need to fertilize the soil with CBT. And some places are not very dialectical. You know, some CBT programs that want to start DBT, they're just really good at the technology. Just they've got it down, and they're in certain ways easier to train. But I find, having trained and supervised people who've come from all different kinds of models, that the CBT people, they already know about cognitive restructuring, and they know about contingencies, they know about exposure, they know about skills, they're comfortable with self-monitoring tools like diary cards and so on. But they might not be very flexible sometimes. They might not be able to improvise very well. They might feel they're betraying the model. And somehow Marshall Linehan, who started as straight CBT, she, though, in her life had come across other experiences that I think really helped her to augment and sort of build into DBT. So, you know, you need to look at the whole set of roots, mindfulness roots. And if there isn't much experience of mindfulness around, you really have to build it in. And if they're not very flexible improvisational, you have to build it in. And behavior, if there's not behaviorism, you really have to go at that. So that's critical. So let me just say that if you just start at the roots, if you just took the task, let's say I gave you all the task, okay, I want you to learn deeply mindfulness principles, mindfulness practices, what this means to be living life with awareness, listening with awareness, for instance, right now between you guys and me. If you were listening to me mindfully, you might be hearing the inflections in my voice. You might be hearing my voice go up, my voice go down. You might be hearing the words. You might be hearing the meanings of what I'm saying. You might be hearing all kinds of subtle shifts. You're paying attention, and you know you're paying attention. That would mean that you're listening mindfully. But if at a certain moment you start thinking, you know what, I don't like this topic. I thought he was going to be talking about this or that or the other. And there's just a little kernel of judgment in there. There's you go off on a little judgment tangent. You're now mindless from a mindful point of view. You've now gone into mindlessness. But then if you say to yourself, you know, I'm aware that I just went off on a little judgmental tangent about this. Now you're mindful again because you're mindful of the judgment. And then if you go off and say some other judgment, you're mindless. And we all go back and forth all the time. But let's say that you learned really about what awareness is, what mindful awareness is, what that capability is, and how to enhance it. And let's say you got to know behaviorism inside and out, every strategy, every principle. And let's say you really got to know dialectics and what it means and how to practice it. And that's all you knew. You didn't know the rest of the tree. And then I say, and you're a psychotherapist. And I say, here, I'm going to refer you an individual with borderline personality disorder. And I want you to apply the intersection, the synthesis of those three principles. It'd be very interesting to see what you came up with. But you probably would come up with something that helped people develop capabilities that attended to motivation in a behavioral way, that highlighted being aware of what you are doing and teaching the skill of being aware and how that can help regulate people. And that helped augment the ability to keep movement going in the face of conflict and impasse. So probably you get some other interesting version that looks a little like DBT. So whatever other DBT program you've got, it should have not only what I said before about it should enhance capabilities and improve motivation, but it should build in these principles. As you go up the tree and you look at the trunk, it's sort of like the generator. The thing that pushes the whole model is the big letters in the middle of the tree, a life worth living. That's really what it's all about. And so it's the sort of central reference point. And you might say just up to there that one uses mindfulness, one uses cognitive behavioral therapy, and one uses dialectics to work to enhance somebody's life. It is not, as has been said many times, a program that is designed to prevent suicide. It's a program that addresses people with suicidal feelings, ideation, behavior, by trying to enhance their life. And so that's the centerpiece of the whole tree. Just below that is the biosocial theory, which I'm not going to spend more time on right now, just because I want to make sure you get the picture of sort of the whole tree and how this fits together. But the biosocial theory, just as it's just a little bit that I put on that diagram, says that, you know, this is a transaction back and forth through the life cycle between the biologically based ability to regulate your emotions and your environment, and especially the aspects of the environment that are not very validating, that are invalidating of your biology. Just as a teaching example, looking away from borderline personality disorder, if you have attention deficit disorder and you are in an environment growing up that thinks you should be able to pay attention and that thinks that it can get you to pay attention by shaming you, or by just telling you to pay attention, or pointing out people who can pay attention, you're going to probably create not only somebody who has all the deficits of attention deficit disorder, but also they're going to have a syndrome of self-invalidation, thinking that they should be able to do things they can't, and no one teaches them the way to compensate for the fact that your brain is not good at paying attention to the things that you don't like to pay attention to. So very similar. It's this balance or transaction between these two things that eventually lead to the primary behaviors of, let's say, suicidal behaviors and other behaviors that are destructive of one's life. So all of that, up to now, we've really covered five things: the three roots, the biosocial theory, and the complete focus on a life worth living. This is all essential ingredients. I don't care what your DBT program is, you're doing all of that. As you'll see, the further we get out from the core of the tree into the branches, the more modifications are made. So let's go over to the branch on the left. There's five primary branches here, as one of my slides that I made in the PowerPoint says, and the one I'm going to call branch number one over to the left is the branch of goals and stages and targets. And that's where you translate the larger concept of a life worth living into concrete goals. What needs to happen for me to get the life that would be worth living and that needs to be discussed with each person? And those goals, if you look over the course of a treatment, are going to be addressed stage by stage. If you look at the little branches on that big branch, there's five of them. And there are in DBT five stages, starting with the stage of pretreatment, and then one through four after that. So as you go along, you'll start with pretreatment and move through the stages, which I think are they on? They're on one of the slides, I think, but we're not going to cover it this moment. But you can see how you break the life worth living into what your goals are going to be. Then over to the right, branch number two, the functions and the modes. They kind of like, if the stages and goals kind of show you longitudinally how DBT evolves to cover one goal and then another goal and then another goal, and with each goal has some targets associated with it. The functions and modes more speaks cross-sectionally. In a program, what are the modes, what are the things the program's doing to get you through the stages, to implement the strategies and to get you to a life worth living? And you'll see there's five branches on that big branch, and those are the five functions, which are on a later slide, so that some part of the program has to attend to each function. We'll come back to this when we talk about the functions, because every one of these things that gets adapted, well, let me say right now, because it follows as I go to the other branches, most programs go through close to the same stages. There's pretreatment. There is stage one that's going to have to do with getting behavior under control. There's stage two, which is going to have to do with the fact that when your behavior is under control, if you've lived the kind of life that people with borderline personality disorder have often lived, you're going to have a suffering individual that's still depressed or anxious or irritated or self-hating or traumatized, and it keeps coming back. So pre-treatment stage, every time. Getting in control stage, every time. Now dealing with painful emotional experiencing pretty much every time if you keep going. The next stage is going to be, if you do a whole treatment long enough, that's going to have to do with regaining some self-respect and pursuing individual goals that have kind of been held up for years, even decades sometimes, while you've been floundering. So that attends to those things that get more and more just like ordinary counseling and therapy, except with a heavy burden of feeling you've lost a lot of time and you've also been stigmatized and you've also had a hard life. And then the last stage, having to do with, you know, really getting meaning into your life. So you're not just going through the motions, but meaning and joy in your life. So those stages are going to be pretty reliably present, and they pretty much overlap if you look at treatments of trauma that last more than just a few months. You know, that's very similar set of stages. There's something basic about this. But when you take each stage and you hammer out the targets of that stage, it's going to vary a lot more. And with the functions, if you do a comprehensive DBT treatment, you're going to have the five functions. You pretty much are. It covers the waterfront of teaching skills, you know, is to enhance people's capabilities. And improving motivation is going to be there. And getting people to generalize the skills they learn to all the relevant environments. And to getting people's lives to be better structured so that it supports what they're trying to do in DBT. And then getting the therapists and the team to be well enough supported to keep doing the treatment. Those are the five functions that come in the later slide. But just talking about them now, any comprehensive DBT treatment, whether you're treating developmental disabilities, teenagers and families, forensic individuals, people on a long-term inpatient unit, eating disorders, substance abuse disorders, you're going to have those five functions. So it's pretty reliable. It's pretty neat, actually, if you look across programs, that you can count on that, unless people are deliberately doing less than five on purpose, and there are choices that need to be made sometimes. But every function is being implemented through a mode or more than one mode, so that the function of improving motivation in one program, in a standard outpatient DBT program, might be implemented through the individual psychotherapy. That's the mode. Mode really means somebody doing something over and over again, offering a certain category of treatment. So individual therapy is designed to improve motivation. However, let's say you've got an inpatient setting where they don't have individual therapists. So if you're going to have improved motivation, you have to be thinking, we've got to accomplish that function. It has to be there. But we don't have individual therapists, so who's going to do it here? And you might have a group therapy that tries to take on the job. If somebody's a skilled group therapist, it could be an incredibly good mode for enhancing motivation. Or it might be that a social worker, a case manager, or a primary nurse, or some team of people. In the community where I work, half of my work is through the University of Massachusetts Department of Psychiatry, a faculty position, which is, and my work is in the Department of Mental Health, the public sector in western and central Massachusetts. So there are certain people with borderline personality disorder who go in and out of hospitals quite a bit the last few years, and we started having meetings about them. And I decided there was really the improving motivation function was sorely it was just that we were weak in our system for a variety of reasons having to do with the nature of therapy in our system and how it's paid for and other things. So we decided to put into place for some people that go in and out of hospitals what we just called an attachment team. And the attachment team is made up of about three people from different avenues, so to speak, in the treatment. And they collaborate together to try to provide significant enough attachment and relationship during the week, and then really try to collaborate on that so that they're working with the same idea of improving motivation. So you see what I mean. In different settings or with different kinds of individuals or different categories of problems, you're going to have different modes, but functions are pretty much always the same. Just to look around the tree now, because I can see how time is going here, when you get to the assumptions, DBT has a very stable, repetitive, from program to program set of assumptions. And they basically, if you look at the assumptions, let's say assumptions about individuals with borderline personality disorder, the assumptions are really of two types. There's about eight assumptions, and they're really made up of about two types of assumptions. One are the type of assumptions that are very accepting of the individual as they are and kind of empathizing and validating. And then the other assumptions are the assumptions that sort of say, you've got to do more if you're going to change this. They're very change-oriented assumptions. You're never going to get up that mountain if you don't start taking the first step. And so you've got change assumptions, acceptance assumptions, and you've got some assumptions that combine change and acceptance in the same assumption. And so you've got those kind of assumptions, but if, let's say you have, like my inpatient program, we added a couple of assumptions that have to do with assumptions to be made about what life is like on an inpatient unit, which is pretty often pretty awful. So, you know, you build in those assumptions and then assumptions about therapy and how it works. So mostly from program to program, your assumptions are going to be about the same, and they're articulated in Linehan's book, and they're re-articulated everywhere you go where you learn DBT. But then there are some specific assumptions that go with different programs. Agreements, same thing. As a CBT treatment, as a behavioral treatment, agreements are a huge thing. That's sort of... they are the collaborative framework for patient and team, patient and therapist, in DBT, so that a patient has a certain number of agreements that they make, a therapist makes a certain number of agreements, and then there's six agreements that are standard across all DBT programs of what the team members are making, the consultation team members. And so the agreements are mostly the same agreements from program to program and treatment to treatment, but they vary. You know, I had certain agreements that are different. When you have a treatment for DBT for substance use, disorders and you've got somebody that's taking a replacement drug like buprenorphine or methadone or something like that, you're going to have certain agreements that have to do specifically with the urine testing and the replacement drugs. And so those will get added on. So you have mostly the same basic agreements and a few add-ons. Final big branch at the top, huge branch, strategies. There are three core groups of strategies in DBT. This doesn't capture all the strategies, but this is kind of day-by-day, bread-and-butter DBT. These are the three sets of strategies. And when I teach intensives and people start to get overwhelmed by about the third or fourth day of learning, think, oh, my God, how am I ever going to remember all these strategies? There's so many strategies, especially so many problem-solving strategies. And you see the lists in Linehan's book of how many strategies, and you just get like, oh, my God, how am I ever going to get these down? But usually about that time when people are getting overwhelmed, if I give a little talk right then about saying, look, guys, it is challenging, but it's not as complicated as you think. Organize all those strategies you've learned into three groups. You're either doing problem solving, which is trying to get people to change, or you're doing validation, which is trying to acknowledge their situation and the reality of their situation, the reality of their point of view, and see in a way the where it's coming from, why it's there, and what the wisdom is in it. So it's not a change-oriented approach. It's an acceptance-oriented approach, in many ways based on a deep application of mindfulness. So you've got problem-solving strategies, or you've got validation strategies, or when things get stuck and you're trying to get things moving again, you're using validation strategies. And that pretty much covers the vast majority of the usual strategies, what Linehan calls the core groups of strategies. And so they're represented as three branches up there. Each branch is going to have a lot of strategies on it. But, you know, there's a certain feel in using problem solving. You feel pushy. There's a feel with validation. You feel empathic. And there's a feel with dialectical strategies, which is you feel like you're trying to get movement happening. You're trying to improvise. You're trying to sort of acknowledge two sides of the coin so that you can kind of get something to happen. And sometimes they're a little off the wall as a paradoxical way to get things moving. So it's nice to realize you've basically got those three sets of strategies, and then you've got a few special sets of strategies that are not exactly covered there. But so I'm seeing that it's already 5 of 9. I'm going to consider that I've given you a pretty reasonable introduction to this tree, and that there's a lot of slides that spell out on the PowerPoint set, you know, more details that you can look at. And there's a few slides about leadership, because whoever is running a DBT program or implementing one, it's good if they have the perspective of this whole tree and as leaders to see what needs to change, what doesn't change, what can change, how do you solve this problem, how do you solve that problem, how do you do it by holding constant the things that need to be held constant, and what are you allowed to change, you know, and still stay within what we assume to be the model until we really get more and more data that tells us exactly what makes this model work and which things are more necessary than others. So I'm going to stop with that, and I see that, you know, with just 5 minutes, I've left it absolutely no chance for anyone to ask a question. But, Perry, I'm going to ask you first, because I think what I'm going to say at the end is just takes 2 or 3 minutes. Is there any burning question, Perry, that came up while I was talking that I might at least take 1 or 2 questions?
Well, I'm going to throw you one that's straight about your talk. Some of the others are a little outside of that. So question, 3 strategies that you mentioned were problem solving, validation, and validation. Is this what you meant?
No, 3 problems. Oh, I probably misspoke. No, problem solving, validation, and dialectical.
Okay.
Dialectical in the middle of the tree. And by the way, if you look carefully at the tree, you don't have to look that carefully off, just look at the tree, you can see that those 3 sets of strategies are directly related to the 3 roots at the bottom of the tree. The mindfulness roots are basically the acceptance-oriented roots. accepting reality in the present moment. And they, in a way, they support the validation strategies. The behaviorism or cognitive behavioral roots give rise to problem solving, and the dialectical roots give rise to dialectical strategies. There's kind of a coherence from the roots up to the strategies.
Mm, beautiful.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the one that's most directly related to what you were talking about so far tonight. Some of the others are great questions, but not as related to your talk. Do you want to go into, Charlie, what we're planning on doing, and then if there's some minutes, what we can do is unmute everybody.
Sure. Here's what I'm thinking of doing. I've been talking with Perry about just thinking that just in my own experience of learning DBT, there's lots of, especially now, there's lots of fabulous training, well-organized, that many of you have been to, and you can find in lots of settings on the Behavioral Tech website, now on the Treatment Implementation Collaborative website, NEABPD trainings, TERRA trainings. There's lots of things, so there's lots of formal trainings, but I thought it might be nice to have a series where it's just possible to talk things to, in a way, month by month, open up a forum where we can discuss things that come up in a way that's sort of more free-flowing, maybe more dialectical. And in thinking about that, where we might talk about just, you know, reflections and personal experiences and opinions and back and forths about treatment models, about new research that comes up, about a new article that's been published, about changes in DSM-5, about the biology of DBT or of BPD and lots of things about mindfulness, dialect, and then beyond DBT, the whole world of borderline personality disorder and different models. So I've now discussed it in the past week with Kelly Kerner, who's an old friend and colleague, and many of you know, and I think she's going to be giving a talk on this, isn't she?
Yes, she's scheduled in a few weeks.
In a few weeks. And Kelly's a wonderful teacher, and many of you probably know who she is. And she runs a thing called the Evidence-Based Practice Institute, and she used to be the president of Behavioral Tech, and we worked closely together. So we've been exchanging emails about this, and she's totally signed on to it. I think she and I are going to get on the phone once a month, and we're going to pick, you know, some kind of topic. And we might bring someone else on who's an expert in something. We've always enjoyed our dialogues about treatment. And so we thought maybe other people would too, or that we could sort of direct this in a way that'll have to do with what your interests are, whoever's out on the phone, and that we could give our own experience, and we could prepare for it partly and just have a free-flowing discussion that isn't confined to a PowerPoint. It isn't confined to making certain teaching points, but it kind of goes in depth in one direction or another, or to personal experiences. So we'll see how it'll go, and we can modify it over time, but that's our design. When we implement it, I'm sure we'll change it as we go, but she has signed on for it. We can't nail down a time yet because she's been away until probably tomorrow, and we were getting down to fine points like when will we do this. And what we're going to do is do that on the Sunday evening time, the same time frame, and we'll do once a month. And so we'll probably start in a month, but I don't want to name the date yet. I'll let Perry put that on her website and send out an email to people who are on this group. And what I want to hear from you through Perry or through NEABPD is, what do you want to hear about? I mean, and this can be, as you can say, from the beginning or in an ongoing way. You can give us feedback and say, we'd like to hear more about this. We haven't heard a thing about this. We'd like to know more. And we always have plenty that we'd be willing to talk about, but it would be nice if we heard input from you guys. So that's really it, Perry. It'll probably evolve as we go along, and I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a different kind of format than anything I think that there really is that's easily available to people.
Well, I think so too, Charlie, and we're so appreciative that you're going to do this with us. First email that came in, great idea, count me in. So I think it's unique. I think it's, for those of you who've been to our conferences, I think there are two things that always get the highest marks. One is for sure is the consumer who speaks. Nobody can match that. But the other is also when there's a panel discussion and when there's dialogue amongst people to talk about any topic. The panel always gets the highest marks, too, because people really enjoy and like to participate in the dialogue that sort of takes the agenda to a higher level rather than just a straight presentation. So I think this is going to be incredibly exciting. I'm going to urge people that they do need to sign up separate for this. And all you need to do is send an email to neabpd@aol.com, and the subject of the email is Charlie, so we'll know that it's specific to this series. And then your address and your phone number and also your affiliation. I also do want to say that this will be pitched to professionals, but as always with our conferences and everything else, everybody's welcome. But just as you saw tonight with Charlie's presentation, it's really geared at the treatment and the parameters of it, and I think everybody benefits. And so we're going to hope professionals join with families and consumers also there, but it's going to be geared to professionals to advance the agenda for DBT. That's the best way that I can say it. So I don't know, Charlie.
But I wouldn't just say DBT. You know, Kelly and I are both involved with other treatment models than DBT. I mean, when I'm talking DBT, I'm talking DBT. But I've also spent a lot of years of my life in psychoanalytic approach to treatment and to families and the biological approaches. And Kelly's done a lot of other things, too. So we're hoping to go, you know, in a number of different directions.
No, absolutely. I stand corrected. I should have said BPD, but and more. So, but I do think it's going to be a unique experience that I don't think anybody's tried before. I do also want to remind everybody that Charlie's giving his time for free. So we're so appreciative and grateful that you're doing this, and we hope that it leads to other things and other people being interested in doing things as well. So, Charlie, I thank
you. Well,
we'll set a date. I think we're thinking of that fourth Sunday every month.
Yeah, if Kelly can do it, we're thinking about the fourth Sunday evening in each month, or as close to that as we can get. So that would put us, you know, about a month from right now.
Terrific. Okay, thank you again, and thank you all for listening, and appreciate the comments that have already come in about this. This is wonderful.
Okay.
All right, everybody, back to the Academy Awards.
Right.
Take care, everybody. Have a good night. Thanks, Charlie.